You are listening to 90.9 WBUR and special live coverage from Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. In a few minutes, we will bring you Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker's 2021 State of the Commonwealth Address live from the State House. It's different this year. A global pandemic means no audience, no legislature, no pomp. But there is certainly plenty of circumstance to discuss. And as we await Governor Baker, let's turn to WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown. Steve, hi there.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Steve, normally you're whispering, you're in the busy chamber, we're asking you about the mood and the feel of the room. None of that this year. How different is the State of the Commonwealth delivery this year?
Yeah, that room is usually packed. Right now, I'm upstairs alone in my bedroom. I guess following almost a year of Zoom meetings, this is as close to a Zoom address as you can get. Legislators are also watching and listening to this from their homes. And I bet Charlie Baker hates this. He tends to feed off the energy of the room. Speeches are often written with those applause lines just baked in. This is as antiseptic as you can get. What also strikes me about this year is with nearly daily COVID updates earlier this past year, we've seen a lot of Charlie Baker. So the novelty of listening to the governor for a half an hour has really passed. I wouldn't be surprised if some folks tune in and go, oh, him again?
Yeah, so Steve, just a heads up to you. We've got about a 30-second warning here, but we aren't going to the governor yet, and we'll just do it real time when it happens. What are you expecting to hear from Governor Baker tonight?
Yeah, I expect him to thank the people of Massachusetts for the sacrifices that they've made over the past year. He'll recognize the heroes that have surfaced, and he's also expected to note some of the positive things that have happened this past year. It's not going to be a total downer. He's also going to be talking about ways that we're going to get beyond the pandemic, how we're going to lead beyond, get the economy going again, and get things back to whatever the new normal will be.
Okay, here we go. Steve Brown, thanks so much. We turn now to the State of the Commonwealth with Governor Charlie Baker with the feed courtesy of Channel 5.
The Cabinet, the Governor's Council, and our friends and families. But this is obviously not a normal year, so I'm sharing my thoughts with you from my office here in the State House. Tonight's address is just one more example of a gathering, a ritual of coming together that's been put on hold by the pandemic. But better days are coming, and like you, Lieutenant Governor Polito and I are looking forward to being able to join with family, friends, and colleagues, because as we all know, there's so much joy in being together. Now, 2020 was a year like no other. The pandemic changed everything, and it was much more than just the worst public health crisis of the last 100 years. It came with economic calamity, severe job loss, business closures, anxiety, fear, civil unrest, riots, racial injustice, isolation, death, and loss. COVID turned everyone's life upside down and did so in a way that oftentimes crippled our ability to share our fears and our loss with those we love. Like many others who have family members in senior living, I went over 100 days last spring without being able to see my dad. It was awful. And at the same time, my best friend lost his mom to COVID, and that was so much worse. Over the past year, thousands have lost their lives, and thousands more have been hospitalized, and we all worry that our loved ones could be next. But because of COVID, we can't visit or hug them. Now, back then, our message was, and still is, clear and compelling. Do the best we can to protect the health and well-being of everyone, keep our economy as open as possible, and keep our kids in school. Last spring, with minimal help from the federal government and our frontline healthcare workers running out of essentials like masks and gloves and gowns, we found a way to deliver 7 plane loads of PPE from all over the world to support them in a matter of weeks. The first came courtesy of the Kraft family and the New England Patriots, and the others followed soon thereafter. We also set up a program to help Massachusetts companies pivot their operations into mask and gown making mini factories. Now we have a stockpile of masks, gloves, and other protective gear to keep our frontline workers safe for years as they treat patients. Back then, we held daily press conferences for almost 4 months to keep everyone informed about what we knew, and just as important, what we didn't. To keep individuals and families informed, we built and maintain one of the most comprehensive daily dashboards available anywhere. And to keep people safe, we built and continue to operate one of the largest free COVID testing systems in the country. Over 13 million tests have been conducted so far, making the Commonwealth the second largest per capita tester in the continental United States. To make sure we understood the science of the virus, we recruited some of the best healthcare minds in the Commonwealth to provide us with guidance and advice. We also responded to the devastating impact COVID had here and all over the world in senior care settings by investing over $400 million in our long-term care facilities. We brought COVID testing programs directly to our long-term care residents and staff, and we recruited experts in infection control to work with industry to help our seniors stay as safe as possible. These efforts combined to dramatically reduce infection rates, hospitalizations, and the loss of life in senior care settings for the past 8 months. And we continue to feed over 1 million people through our food security programs. Millions of private, federal, and state dollars have combined with local efforts and private nonprofits to support families across the Commonwealth. Through it all, our aim has been to keep you as factually informed as possible, to keep people safe, the economy going, and our schools open. And as the federal vaccine distribution program kicks into high gear over the next few months, anyone who wants a vaccine will be able to get one at a site near them, and we can start to put this pandemic behind us. Now, as you know, our economy and the jobs and purpose that come with it have been pounded throughout this pandemic. Last February, our economy was humming, but COVID hammered it. Now, led by Lieutenant Governor Polito, we worked with public health experts and business leaders across every sector of our economy to gradually reopen without rekindling the virus. And over the next few months, hundreds of thousands of residents went back to work. Today, we're in much better shape economically than we were last spring. But far too many people still can't find a job, our downtowns are hurting, and many of our small businesses have been crushed by the pandemic. Our small business relief program, the largest of its kind in the country, has made a real difference. This program is putting over $700 million into the hands of struggling small businesses so that they can get to the other side of this second surge. Thousands of companies have already received over $230 million in grants, and thousands more will benefit from this effort over the next several weeks. Our Shared Streets program came out of our weekly discussions with local officials and has made it possible for municipalities to reimagine their downtowns so that more people could eat outside when it's nice or safely ride a bike or walk to parks or schools. But here, too, there's much that remains to be done. Now, if there's a silver lining in all this, it's how organizations and individuals from every corner of Massachusetts stepped up to confront the pandemic and care for each other. These heroes are the most beautiful part of this most difficult experience. Their resilience, creativity, and commitment gives me hope. And because of who they are and what they do, I can say to you tonight that I know the state of our Commonwealth is strong. The healthcare system in Massachusetts is the envy of the world, and they've reaffirmed that throughout this pandemic. Under-equipped, overwhelmed, and struggling to learn how to fight back and beat down a brand new virus, they have and continue to give this battle everything they have. Fire, EMS, law enforcement, our first responders in the Massachusetts National Guard come whenever they're called while risking infection and illness. Grocery store workers and countless small businesses feed, assist, and console their communities. Caregivers, many of whom have never taken a day off, provide 24/7 attention to children with special needs and our most at-risk populations. The Salvation Army, the Red Cross, YMCAs, food banks, pantries, and hundreds of charitable organizations pivoted on a dime to feed, shelter, and assist those in need. The individual efforts, the ones we don't hear a lot about, carry just as big an impact and are no less noteworthy. Neighbors in Milton banding together to collect furniture, pots, pans, and bedding to help a local pastor move a woman into a new apartment after she ended up at his church with nowhere to go. A young woman from Western Mass who refused to quit completed her 10-year journey from custodian to nurse practitioner at Bay State Medical Center in the middle of the pandemic so she could do more to take care of the sick. A restaurant owner in Quincy opened his doors to feed needy families, only to be followed by what would normally be his competition down the street, who did the same thing. Wedding photographers, planners, and a facility operator volunteered to put together a wedding for an Army sergeant from Chicopee and his fiancée after their plans were upended by COVID. My wife, Lauren, the First Lady, and several volunteers stood up the Massachusetts COVID-19 Relief Fund and raised over $32 million from 17,000 donors. And this effort helped over 500 community organizations and hundreds of thousands of families with food, rent, and other emergency assistance. The Boston Bruins national anthem singer, a staff member at the Commonwealth's Probation Department, sang his heart out at food pantries and lifted up exhausted healthcare workers between their shifts.
You're listening to WBUR's live coverage of the State of the Commonwealth address by Governor Charlie Baker at the State House.
That we owe a huge debt to for helping us get through this. They and all those who find the strength and compassion to support their friends and neighbors are our heroes. And while COVID returned this fall with a vengeance, here in Massachusetts, we're seeing our way through it. Our entire healthcare community, while stretched, has the gear they need to take care of patients and far more knowledge about what works and what doesn't than they had 10 months ago. While we still have many challenges, our testing infrastructure is far more robust than it was in the spring. Our employers have adopted the guidance we issued to keep their employees and customers safe. And schools do remain open despite the continued presence of COVID. Now, study after study makes clear that kids need to be in school. Their educational and emotional development depends on it. And while in-person learning is especially challenging during this time, many schools have found a way to get it done. Relying on state guidance as well as federal and state funding, many state special education programs, early education providers, and some school districts have been able to make in-person education work safely since the fall. The Commonwealth's parochial schools, many of which serve primarily black and brown children and their families in many high-risk communities, have been delivering mostly in-person education to over 45,000 kids since mid-August. Many teachers, parents, and staff throughout Massachusetts are making it happen, and we should be justifiably proud of their work. To encourage more public school districts to reopen their classrooms, we've been working with a number of lab partners to develop a weekly COVID testing program for kids, teachers, and staff. The goal is to get as many kids as possible back into the classroom as soon as possible. And this first-in-the-nation COVID testing program will help more school districts make the call to offer full-time in-person instruction now. On Beacon Hill, our colleagues in the legislature overcame some very difficult operational challenges and managed to debate and enact critical legislation on a wide range of issues. Some of that legislation provided much-needed short-term relief to our citizens, while other bills will position the Commonwealth for a bright post-pandemic future. To provide immediate relief, tax filing and payment dates were extended on several occasions to give residents and employers more time to meet their obligations. Without raising taxes or fees, together, we funded essential state and local services, including education, social services, public health, and public safety. We also included additional funds for small business supports, rental assistance, and food support. And with an eye toward the future, we worked with our colleagues in the legislature to enact legislation on transportation, economic development, housing, healthcare, and police reform. The horrific murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis brought the issue of systemic racism to the forefront of our national dialogue, and it forced important conversations here in the Commonwealth. Thankfully, we did more than just have a conversation. we acted and passed one of the most comprehensive police reform laws in the country. The new law bans chokeholds, limits no-knock warrants, and creates a new independent state entity with the power to establish policing standards, certify law enforcement officers, investigate allegations of misconduct, and suspend or revoke certification. I'm so proud to be able to say that these reforms were discussed, debated, and passed here without the rancor, and in many cases, the lack of progress that dominated this discussion in so many other places. And we've also been a national leader on health care, and the health care reform law enacted by the legislature at the end of the session makes services like telehealth, which were a key part of our pandemic response, permanent. Telehealth visits, online or over the phone, were made possible by an emergency order we issued last spring. And patients and clinics took full advantage. People who used to put off that clinician visit because they were busy flocked to this service. Over a million visits in less than 9 months. It was convenient and safe, and it kept people healthy and out of the emergency room. But it wasn't permanent. Well, now it is, and we'll all benefit from the flexibility and availability of this critical service. On transportation, the new law accelerates bridge reconstruction so we can move faster to modernize every bridge that needs major repairs. It also provides the funding we need to complete the South Coast Rail expansion. Now, Fall River and New Bedford have been waiting for over 30 years for this to get done. It will now be available in 2023. This law also funds the final piece of the long-promised Green Line extension into Somerville. These are big promises made and kept. Just in time for the $600 million economic development bill, which will help us invest in our post-pandemic recovery. Resources here will help small businesses, support investments in struggling downtowns, create housing people need and can afford, and put people to work. I want to give a special shout out to the legislature for including the housing choice legislation that we filed several years ago. This will reform our exclusionary zoning rules, which have stymied housing production in the Commonwealth for decades. Communities can now move forward much more quickly to permit and build the housing that we all know we need. On climate change, Massachusetts continues to be a national leader. In the last several weeks alone, we put forth a science-based roadmap to reach net zero emissions by 2050, and we spearheaded a first-of-its-kind multi-state program to reduce carbon emissions in the transportation sector. We've invested over $935 million in climate change mitigation and adaptation since we took office, and we're on track to meet our commitment to invest $1 billion in climate action by 2022. Partnering with the legislature, we secured historic clean energy procurements at the lowest price for ratepayers, and this set the table for an explosion in offshore wind development up and down the east coast of this country. There's no question more needs to be done.
You are listening to WBUR's live coverage of the State of the Commonwealth Address by Governor Charlie Baker at the State House.
And energy efficiency, and we look forward to working with our legislative colleagues to make this happen. Now, as we come out of the pandemic, one issue we need to get right is the future of work. Many people have gotten used to working remotely and may not want to come back to the office 5 days a week. Businesses big and small have learned how to attract new customers and support their existing ones without physically being with them. Virtual conferences have replaced in-person ones, and many companies have found ways to recruit and train new employees all remotely. Everything from business travel to training, recruiting, and sales have undergone massive transformation and will continue to adapt and evolve. These discoveries have big consequences for how people commute, where they live, where they work, and who they work for. And this will impact commercial centers, downtowns, transportation, and public spaces. It's critical that we understand this and lean into what this reset means so that we create the community building, housing, economic development, and transportation programs that align with these changes. Make no mistake, we've always lived by our wits, figured out the future, and got there first, and this time will be no different. Finally, I want to talk about the light at the end of this dark tunnel. vaccines. Thankfully, the scientific community, many from right here in Massachusetts, came through and created highly effective, thoroughly tested, and safe vaccines. And people are now being vaccinated. Vaccinating 4 million adults in Massachusetts as the doses are allocated by the federal government is not going to be easy. But be assured we'll make every effort to get this done as quickly and as efficiently as possible. Common sense says that we should prioritize the most vulnerable among us and those who keep our healthcare system operating, and we can only move as fast as the federal government delivers the vaccine. Everyone has shown tremendous patience throughout this long ordeal, and many are justifiably running out of it. I am too. And that's why this can't happen fast enough. By the end of this week, we'll have 103 vaccination sites open to the public with the ability to administer about 240,000 doses each week. And by mid-February, we'll have 165 public sites, including 7 mass vaccination sites. And altogether, we'll have capacity to administer approximately 305,000 doses every week. From large-scale facilities at stadiums to local sites at health clinics, we're working to reach vulnerable populations and get as many people protected as soon as doses are delivered to the Commonwealth. Beginning tomorrow, people over the age of 75 can make an appointment to receive their first dose. Please visit mass.gov/COVID vaccine to find out when you're eligible and to book an appointment when it's your turn. I know that a great deal has been asked of you over the past 11 months, and I'm grateful for the endless sacrifices so many of you have made in order to keep your family and your friends and your neighbors safe. The end is in sight, but for the next few months, we must continue to stay vigilant and take the steps that we all know to stop the spread. But know this, we will beat this virus, and life will begin to return to normal. Now, before I close, I want to offer some thoughts on the mood of the nation and the events of the past year. I can't recall in my brief time on Earth anything quite like this. I'm sure historians, with the benefit of time and hindsight, will have a lot more to say about it than whatever I might say tonight. I know a lot of us watched a lot of TV over the past year. The pandemic drove us inside, and the streaming services and cable networks took full advantage of that. Well, the show that sticks with me is Ted Lasso. It's positive, charming, heartfelt, and subtle. Big high fives to Saturday Night Live's Jason Sudeikis. I won't bore you with the details, but there was a moment in that show when Ted turns down the volume in a tense encounter and quotes a Walt Whitman phrase he saw on a banner at his son's high school. All it said was, "Be curious, not judgmental." He goes on to talk about how curious people learn things they didn't know, while judgmental people learn not much at all. And then he sticks the landing. I've talked a lot over the past 6 years about collaboration and respect, about seeking common ground, about focusing on the issues and not on the personalities. And I get that it's harder to collaborate and it's harder to show respect in a time of high anxiety and trauma. But I would suggest that it's more important during times like these to ask questions, to be curious, to show empathy, and to maintain an open mind than it is to make brash statements and name call. Social media, too many politicians, and too many talking heads thrive on takedowns and judgments. It's become the source of so much anger and hatred in this world that I often wish I could just shut it all off for a month and see what happens. Over time, too much of our daily discourse has come to resemble it. Not curious, just judgmental. In the end, this makes it harder for us to understand one another, to learn from one another, and most importantly, to grow. My interest in filing a police accountability bill came from conversations with people whose life experiences were different than mine. I listened, I learned, and I grew. Besides putting COVID in the rearview mirror once and for all, My biggest wish for 2021 is for all of us to take Walt Whitman's charge to heart. Be curious, not judgmental. If we do, I believe we will all grow. And hopefully we'll all learn a few things we didn't know before and be glad that we did. We'll also be happier and healthier and can use our newfound knowledge and understanding to work together to build a better, stronger Commonwealth as we come out of this awful pandemic. I want to thank you for watching, and God bless this Commonwealth, and God bless the United States of America. Good night.
And that was Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker delivering his 2021 State of the Commonwealth Address. The feed was courtesy of Channel 5 Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is special live coverage from WBUR's Radio Boston. Listening in with us tonight are Marie St. Fleur, the former Massachusetts state representative and now chief executive officer of a cannabis company, and Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald. And we will get their analysis. We'll spend some time on that in a moment. But first, I want to bring back WBUR senior statehouse reporter Steve Brown, who was also listening. Steve touched bases with us just before the speech started. Hey, Steve, welcome back.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So what stood out to you, Steve?
Well, not surprisingly, the vast majority of that speech was all about this past year and the COVID situation that we've been in that has just dominated our lives. It's dominated state government. So therefore, it's obvious he had to talk about that the entire time. That was definitely there foremost. He did talk about some of the other accomplishments, legislative accomplishments, which is typical of a State of the Commonwealth address, where they go back and say, hey, we did this and we did that, police reform, health care reform, different things like that. He did touch on those. But again, it really was centered on COVID, the way we've been living our lives the past year, and how we're going to get out of it beyond here.
So I want to reflect with you for a minute, Steve, because the governor talked about these 4 months of press conferences that he just one day started holding as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. You and I covered a bunch of those together. It was really interesting to hear him lay out the litany of work engaged in by really the whole Commonwealth, especially in those first 4 months, that period of time when everyone was scrambling just to figure out what to do next. Did you feel he was effective in sort of giving people the sum total of that work?
Yeah, when you list it all together, and I attended probably 90% of those news conferences over the past year. Most of them were at the State House. Some of them were out at New Balance in Lawrence, where they were making masks. We're down in Fall River where they were making other PPE. Just different things to show off what was being done. And, you see it, as it's being done, but to have it all listed and see it in front of you of, oh, yeah, we did this in the past year. I mean, let's face it, a year ago, none of us knew what PPE was.
No, we didn't know what any of those acronyms were, and kind of to that point. So we are well into the governor's second term now. And in past years, we and others have talked about Governor Baker's reluctance to kind of stake a claim with a bold vision of the Commonwealth, being much more of a nuts and bolts management kind of governor. Then along comes 2020 and 2021 so far, which have really required a lot of nuts and bolts management. Has that, been a vindication of the governor's style and approach in his office?
I believe so. The past year, not a lot of drama. It was just him saying, okay, we're going to do this and we want to do that. So, again, I was listening back to some coverage of past State of the Commonwealth addresses, and I referred to him a name that he had been called Mr. Fix-It. And, that's he's kind of doing that or has been attempting to do that all this past year. And that's what he was reflecting back on for this evening.
And so now looking forward, did you hear anything in the speech tonight that you thought was arguably visionary about what comes next?
I don't know about visionary, but practical. Is it just the practical things of getting people vaccinated so that we can get back to whatever the new normal will be? And I hate that expression, new normal, but it is so apt. He did reflect in the speech about how our vision of work has changed, And, you know, with people working from home and realizing they can work from home, once the pandemic is over and done with, a lot of people are going to still want to work from home. They may want to go in and see their colleagues, but, you know, they're going to be doing this new way of doing things thanks to the pandemic.
So do you think the plans that he laid out tonight are achievable? We didn't get a ton of them. It's not like last year when he focused on his big budget measures and a huge legislative agenda for this year. But from what he did say, did you see an achievable set of goals?
Well, it's yes, that, you know, get the vaccine out as best you can. You know, as he has always pointed out, the problem, one of the problems is not knowing how much vaccine we'll be getting from the feds. You know, we're seeing now with the Biden administration, hasn't even been in office for a week, that they may be getting some clearer answers about how much vaccine they are going to be getting. So it'll be a chance that they can actually put these vaccines into the arms of people through the system that the state has set up.
All right. So last but not least, before we let you go, read the tea leaves. Is this a guy who's going to run for a third term?
I think he really likes the job, although this past year has probably taken a lot out of him. A lot of people that I know that I go to these news conferences, you know, several times a week, they've said to me, you know, is he okay? He looks tired. And one time I brought that up to him, and he kind of laughed about that. But let's face it, this has been a grueling year for him. And he's been getting criticized from both sides. Some people saying he's going too fast. Some people have been saying he's going too slow. And so it was, you know, sometimes he just can't catch a break. So that may take the wind out of his sails and say, hey, at the end of this term, okay, that's enough. But, you know, he does have an opportunity to become the longest serving governor in Massachusetts history if he is to go have three complete terms, consecutive terms, something no one has done spanning 12 years if he were to stay the whole 12 years.
Well, that will be something to watch for. That's WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So let's turn now to our analysts, Marie St. Fleur, who's a former Massachusetts state representative and now chief executive officer of a cannabis company, and Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald. Marie and Joe, thanks for joining.
Good to be with you.
So Marie, I'll start with you. Did you hear what you expected to hear tonight? Marie,
I heard what I expected. I'm not certain I heard all that I wanted. I think he laid out. I think people are exhausted. We've had a traumatic 4 years, and the last year particularly has been even more so. And so I think he tried to elevate the work of the Commonwealth, of the people of the Commonwealth, the government of the Commonwealth, and to highlight the positive things that has occurred here that show all of us pulling together. I go back to what I said last year. I don't know what did not get a vision of where we were going in terms of the larger issues that we're facing in this Commonwealth, particularly in communities of color, particularly in low-income communities. I did not get a real picture about what coming out of this will mean for those communities and what will be different, because those communities are not really looking at how they will be able to stay home. They have been out and they will continue to be out working. Yes.
So, and Marie, as I turn to Joe Battenfeld, you make a good point. We specifically asked the two of you to join us tonight. You were our analysts for the 2020 State of the Commonwealth Address, and having that kind of compare and contrast seems so important tonight. So with that in mind, Joe Battenfeld, I'll turn to you. Did you hear what you expected to hear?
Not exactly. I did. There were some things I did expect that he got into. And quoting Ted Lasso, I think, was a bit of a surprise there that he threw in.
Yeah, I don't think any of us had Jason Sudeikis on our bingo cards.
No, I didn't. I didn't at all. But, you know, I think this thing that struck me was the difference in a year. What a difference a year makes. The just the optics of the speech are so much different. Rather than speaking in front of the legislature and them giving him applause every 10 seconds, you know, he's got to stand there and give a long speech and, you know, a serious speech at times, very serious. I thought it was a very important speech for him, especially considering the fact that he's considering running for a third term. But it was very different, obviously, than a year ago. I do think he glossed over a few things in the speech, like Marie said. I think I agree with her. You know, the tragic deaths of the patients at the Holyoke Soldiers Home, the fact that Massachusetts had one of the worst unemployment records in the nation during this pandemic, he glossed over that. But I wouldn't really expect him to get into that too much. It was more, he was trying to be more hopeful than just gloom and doom, which was a good idea, I think.
I also noticed, and Marie, maybe you can address this, especially since you already raised questions of equity, especially for our communities of color in the Commonwealth. He talked about transportation, but he did not talk about the T cuts and the terrible hits that public transportation has taken as a result of this pandemic. Now, as Joe says, of course, in the state of the Commonwealth, you're not going to give a litany of what went wrong and what you might see as your failures. But was it striking to you to not have transit come up in that way, or not have him address how we get our transit for our essential workers back up and fully running again?
I mean, as a community, living in the community, I'm not certain how that speech left folks, you know? So it was strange. And to me, there was such an opportunity right now to actually signal to these communities about what we've learned about the disparities that COVID unveiled. So yes, we pulled together, but it also exposed some real gaps in opportunity in this state. And there were those who were able to stay home and those who had to go to work because they were essential, but those who were essential are not necessarily even earning a living wage. And there was such an opportunity to talk about some of what that he spoke about last year, where he talked about housing and expanding housing, where he talked about, you know, making certain that transportation functions better, where he talked about climate change, all of those are opportunities to rebuild better, so to speak, right? Those are the buzzwords now. And that creates opportunity for communities that have been left behind or stuck. And those connections were made to talk about that more inclusive economy that will hopefully open up in Massachusetts once we get this COVID behind us. There was not even an outreach to the communities, because if you look at who's taking the vaccines and who's not, there's a real fear, right?
Yeah, in communities of color that.
About taking that vaccine. And so there was no outreach to that community to say, to really ask them and assure them that it was safe to take it and that will be on our way. I'm certain he does it in his regular meetings that he has on TV, those regular briefings, but there was an opportunity to pull all of that together. And so I almost feel like the community was left out.
That is a powerful statement, Marie. Joe Battenfeld, I want to turn to you. I have a different question I want to ask you, but let me just see if there's anything you want to add to what we just heard from Marie on that subject first.
No, I just think it was a great point that Marie made. And the fact that he didn't address the concerns about the vaccine, maybe he just didn't want to come across as lecturing people, because he can come across like that sometimes. But I think he could have addressed more, and he could have spoken directly to people and people of color and people, you know, who are at risk, more at risk, and said, you know, hey, this vaccine is safe. You can take it safely. And he could have directly, you know, talked to people like that, but he didn't at all.
I'm Tiziana Deering, and you are listening to a Radio Boston special coverage on WBUR of the State of the Commonwealth Address that was delivered just a bit ago by Governor Charlie Baker from the State House. We have with us Marie St. Fleur and Joe Battenfeld providing us some analysis. Staying with you, Joe, you know, I went back and listened to last year today, And before the speech, you had said that you really expected to hear Governor Baker say some things on climate, that that was going to need to be an important part of his agenda in 2020. He did address it here in the State of the Commonwealth tonight. But interestingly, he left out that the legislature delivered him a bill last minute, right? He had 10 days to either veto it or sign it. There wasn't any time to negotiate. He vetoed it, and they're sending it to him again later this week in the exact same condition it was when they sent it the first time. So is he, how do we read that? Is he in trouble with the legislature? Is this just a negotiating tactic? And did he do what he needed to do on climate in 2020, understanding that there was a global pandemic to deal with as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great point that he didn't mention the fact that he vetoed it, and the fact that the legislature is very likely to override that veto. Maybe that's why he didn't mention it, because he's going to lose on this one. But he didn't, you know, didn't want to raise the stakes of it too much. But he could have, he certainly could have gone into it deeper, especially considering the, you know, the importance of the speech last year, that he gave it last year. So he kind of, he did kind of gloss over the whole issue, I think. And you know, the other thing that struck me in the speech was that, you know, he has been coming under increased scrutiny for his handling of the pandemic lately. And in fact, he changed his plan, his vaccine plan, just yesterday to bump up people who are 75 and older and 65 and older into higher priority, because of all the criticism that he was getting. So he didn't mention that at all. I thought that was interesting. And it struck me again how many holes there were in the speech.
So Marie, one of the pieces of legislation that he did talk about and he spoke with great pride was the police reform legislation that did get passed. Of course, there was back and forth. The House version was different than the Senate version. Then it went to the governor. He did send it back with some changes that some of the strongest advocates for police reform felt weakened it some. He pointed out some of the big areas, you know, some civilian oversight, limits on no-knock warrants, elimination of chokeholds. Did he strike the right tone there? And are you satisfied with the leadership he provided and is going to provide going forward on police reform?
So I think it's a difficult issue. One, I'm glad we finally got some police reform out of the Massachusetts legislature. I think in terms of the whole mandatory certification issue, I think we were probably we were 42nd in the country. I might be misstating that, but we were not ahead of the game there. So we were catching up.
Yeah, there were only a few states that didn't provide certification. Yes.
Yeah, we're catching up with the rest of the country. And so I think it's positive that we headed in that direction. I think that the issue around the chokehold, I mean, that was an issue that was part of the Obama plan. You know, President Obama, as part of the DOJ, when they looked at police reform those many years ago, that was an issue that came up and many states had picked up. So the ban, the chokehold issue. The independent, I think the most positive piece of this for me is the independent body, where a majority of the independent board that will conduct investigations and adjudications into misconduct, so that people will have some trust that there is oversight, transparency, and accountability. I think that is one of the most positive pieces that came out. So I will say kudos that it happened, and it happened with the push of many people. And I think the proof will be in how it's implemented, because the challenge with a lot of this legislation is it gets done and then we move on, but it's going to be in how it's put up, and that we need to keep an eye on it to make certain that what is passed actually gets implemented.
So Joe Battenfeld, the other big policy issue I heard tonight that I wanted to ask about, it sounded like the governor was throwing down again about getting young people and kids back into school. He even noted that parochial schools have been doing it for months with success. Was that a pressure play from the governor, or was that a plea now that there's pooled testing coming? How did you take what he had to say there?
I thought it was a continuation of his policies, which have been, in fact, in favor of getting more kids into school, into in-school learning. And so I think it's a continuation of that. And he wanted to emphasize that, which I think is a good thing. I do think more kids should be in school, and we should be doing everything possible to get them in school. So I'm glad he mentioned it. Maybe he knows he has critics on that. So he knows that the teachers are going to come after him on that. So maybe he was throwing down a little bit early just to prevent that.
And do you think, Joe, are we going to have large scale in-class attendance by the end of the year here?
I think by the end of the year, I think it's likely that we will. I'm hoping that we will by the end of the year as the vaccines become more available, you know, and more schools start to open. I think it's probably pretty likely, yeah.
So, Marie, I'll come back to you. Last year at the end of the governor's speech, he made a reference that was more veiled than his reference this year to the things that divide us and where we were in our state of politics. Of course, it's been one thumping year since then, and he addressed it even more head on and talked about our need to pull together. He's always shown pride. He did at the beginning of the speech in the way the Commonwealth has pulled together. It was a striking compare and contrast between all the efforts he cited to take care of each other and then all the tension we've seen here in the Commonwealth, in our own internal political divides, you know, tensions around business closings and mask wearings. In the end, is the Commonwealth unified?
That's a loaded question, Tatiana. I don't know that the Commonwealth... you know what? I think that the Commonwealth is struggling like every place else to find its footing about how we move forward together. And I think the important thing is that there's a line of communication that exists in the Commonwealth that perhaps does not exist in many other places. So are there challenges? Absolutely. And I'm glad he raised them. To his credit, he has stood up on this issue, and I've appreciated his leadership, because there are places where it's important that our democracy to state clearly that our democracy must work better, and for our democracy to work, that everybody must have a seat at the table, that everybody's votes should be counted, and that everybody has to be treated fairly, and nobody's above the law. And I think he has said those things really loudly. I think we need to look in Massachusetts about how we apply that practically across the Commonwealth. I know I always say, you know, I have a bias about Boston because it's home for me, but everybody always points the finger at Boston in so many ways when we are asking about questions about diversity, when we're asking about question about access to the vote. And I beg everybody to begin to look beyond Boston and across the Commonwealth and see whether or not we are doing some of the things that we need to do in order to make certain that everybody's voices is heard in this government.
Yep. And so last 30 seconds to you, Joe Battenfeld, and I mean it, we're on a little bit of a tight time here. Is this a governor who can run again with his own party's support?
That's going to be a tough one. We had over a million people who voted for Trump, a million Republicans who voted for Trump in this state. They're not big fans of Charlie Baker right now. And so I think he's already got one challenger potentially looming in the Republican Party, and there could be others. And so, you know, I think he's got a tough road ahead to unify his own party.
All right. That is Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald, and Marie St. Fleur, a former Massachusetts state representative, now CEO of a cannabis company. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been special live coverage from WBUR's Radio Boston of Governor Charlie Baker's 2021 State of the Commonwealth Address. Sure appreciate you listening tonight. I'm Tiziana Deering.